coming up on Philosophy Talk.
When you have a hammer, the actual part of your brain that sees itself in the world extends.
The extended mind.
Is the body just a tool for the mind, or part of the essence of the mind?
Take the very idea of thought itself. It's a metaphorical idea based on the body.
If you have me in mind, do you have me in your head?
Perception is never passive. Every idea you have is physically there in your brain.
Our guest is cognitive scientist George Lakoff.
The same parts of the brain that are used for acting, for perceiving, for moving, for hearing, are also used for imagining, seeing, moving, and hearing.
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
Thought itself and concepts come out of the embodiment, out of your interactions with the world, and out of the way your brain is structured via its connection to the body.
The extended mind.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, the extended mind.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people will find that puzzling as a description of a philosophical topic of some interest.
How so, John? How do you think? Why?
Well, most people are pretty clear what the mind is. It's the seat of thought, consciousness, emotion, that sort of stuff.
That sounds about right.
And we know what it is to be extended. It's to take up space, to be stretched out through space and maybe over time.
So what's exactly the issue then if we know both those things?
Well, the question is, what's not the issue? I mean, Descartes distinguished what he called the thinking substance, the mind, from what he called extended substance, material objects that occupy space. That's not a very trendy view these days. That's what's called Cartesian dualism, the idea that the mind isn't extended. But most people think it is extended. Pretty much it's the brain. So are we just beating that dead horse again?
Well, now look, even if we grant that the mind does occupy space, there's still a big question left. Just where in space is the mind?
Oh, let me think. How about between the skull? The mind is just the brain working. Hence, the mind resides in the skull, QED.
Well, but you're thinking of the mind in the wrong way. You're thinking of it as a little black box locked up inside our heads. It's something separate and distinct from the body in which it's contained and separate and distinct from the environment that surrounds the body.
Well, I'm thinking of it as something between our skull that is made to order to control a body in a certain environment. But, yes, basically you're right. What's wrong with that?
Well, for one thing, it's actually a very Cartesian way of thinking about the mind, except for the part where you're willing to grant that the mind is a material thing. But still, by making it an entirely separate from the body, you're really just repeating Descartes' mistake.
Oh, really? That's a pretty big except, right? What's wrong with thinking of the mind as separate and distinct from the body? Seems like sort of common sense.
Well, because if these folks who believe in extended or embodied or situated cognition are right, it's part of the essence of the mind to be embodied and situated. The mind, body, and environment, that's not three separate and entirely distinct things, but it's one massively interactive, massively interconnected whole. That's what's wrong.
Poppycock. Look, I live in a house. The house is in a city. The city's in a country. All these things fit together, work together. I couldn't live nearly so well not in a house. That doesn't mean that I and my house are one massively interacting and interconnected whole. That's just gibber talk.
Well, but look. I want you to do something for me. I want you to reach for that bottle of water and take it into your hand. I want you to see if you can do that.
All right. I'm reaching for it, and I'm taking it into my hand. What's your point?
Well, you pulled that off quite effortlessly. I want to congratulate you. But look, I want to tell you something. The reason you were able to do so is because, well, the human hand is a really cool thing. Really cool thing.
Well, let's see. You've got the opposable thumb. I've heard that that's important.
Yeah, that's a cool thing, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the collapsibility of the hand. Because of the way the hand naturally collapses, you didn't have to actually do a lot of calculating to grab that bottle. You didn't have to independently calculate a trajectory for each individual finger, for example.
Well, I see your point. All my brain had to do was calculate the trajectory that got my hand into the rough vicinity of the bottle. And then from that point on, the hand just sort of took over automatically, collapsing around the bottle till I could grab it.
Right, right, exactly. So now you're getting the point. When the body moves, some of the work of making it move in just the way it's done is, some of that work is done by that little computer in the skull that we call a brain. That's true.
And, sure, some of the work is done by the body itself.
And if you think of the mind as whatever is ultimately responsible for movement, then you can't just identify the mind with the brain, with the inner computer.
Well, I don't know. I mean, suppose I tell my computer to print a document, and then the printer prints the document, and I say, oh, I guess the computer's really part of the printer, or the something like that. They're part of an interconnected whole, blah, 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 blah. It's really simple. There's two different things that work in tandem. What's the problem?
Well, look, no, it's not two different things. They're interconnected whole, and it's not an either-or thing either. When you're talking about the mind, we're talking about a complex, about the brain-body complex, and there's no fixed boundary between the mind and the body.
Okay, I mean, I'll play along. You've either drunk the Kool-Aid or you're pretending awfully well to have done so, and I can do the same. I can see that if you start down this route, there won't be any reason to stop at the boundaries of the body. The structure of the environment is at least as important to the nature of the cognition as the structure of the body. And we can think of external memory aids that we have nowadays, like my wonderful iPhone that has a calculator and a syncable calendar built in.
Exactly.
They're just part of my extended mind.
Exactly.
Have I got it right, John.
Technology, modern technology, it's a cool thing because one of the things that it enables us to do, it enables us to offload onto the environment, the built environment, cognitive tasks that in earlier times the brain had to perform all on its own. Modern technology extends the mind right out into the world.
That gives us a lot to think about. But joining us to discuss the extended mind, we're lucky to have Berkeley's own George Lakoff, co-author of Philosophy in the Flesh, The Embodied Mind and Its Challenge to Western Thought.
And we want to offload part of this conversation to our audience here at The Marsh.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, investigates how embodied cognition applies to the virtual world. She files this report.
Jaron Lanier is a man of varied talents. He's a musician.
When you learn to improvise at the piano and you get good at it, there's this moment when you find your hands seemingly coming up with these solutions to voice leading and harmony problems.
But Lanier's also a writer and a researcher at University of Southern California and at Microsoft Research. Lanier is considered the father of virtual reality, and he was among the first to develop and become an avatar, a computer graphic used to represent a person in a virtual world. Back in the 80s, Lanier wanted to create avatars to allow more than one person to inhabit a virtual world. So the team developed bodysuits and gloves with sensors that would detect movement.
And it worked. We were able to put on these full body suits and turn into avatars. It was extraordinary.
The first avatar was flawed, but Lanier said that made it even more interesting.
I remember being this avatar and looking at my hand, and there being a bug that caused my hand to be very, very big, like bigger than the city of Berkeley.
He found himself surrounded by his own hand in a virtual world. Strangely, he could control it and hit targets, which surprised him at first.
That functionality, the fact that you could just gracefully turn into this totally bizarre avatar, really was intriguing and kind of surprising.
This discovery allowed people to transform into exotic avatars like lobsters, dinosaurs, and even molecules. You learn to manipulate claws you don't actually have and fly like a prehistoric bird. This technology laid the groundwork for games like Nintendo's Wii and Microsoft's Kinect. Lanier saw this and started theorizing about homuncular flexibility, the idea that the brain has a sort of embedded map of the body that allows it to control the body. Lanier pictures an impish figure stretched across the brain.
This impish creature is called a homunculus, and the reason it's impish is that some parts of the body that have a lot of nerve connections, like the thumb, for instance, are disproportionately big, and so you have this really sort of icky-looking creature.
When we transform into avatars that are not human, our brains must quickly figure out a new map to control a new body. And this process, according to Lanier, is kind of a trip.
The fact that you can learn to control a body that's not even connected like a human body is really interesting.
But why should our brains learn to control bodies that are totally unlike our own? Lanier credits evolution.
With some of the really exotic things, you do wonder if maybe some old circuitry might survive from a time when an ancestor of our brain was controlling an ancestor of ours that had a different body form and maybe different degrees of freedom, different limbs and so forth.
And that led to really exotic discoveries, like turning the human body into a molecule or even a mathematical equation or computer code. But what can a person do as a molecule that a person can't do as a person?
Well, what we really want to do is be able to think like a molecule. So the way molecules are is they're always jiggling around. They're thermal, and they jiggle through these degrees of freedom. And so if you can map your body to the ways a molecule can be, so instead of it jiggling, you just dance in order to explore the different spaces it can get into, and then you can interact with other molecules.
Lanier believes that by becoming a molecule, students will better understand what molecules are and how they function. And this kind of embodied cognition could open our minds in ways we never would have imagined.
We might be able to have thoughts we wouldn't otherwise have had. And of course, we don't know yet if it might lead in that direction. But that's the sort of thing one dare not think, but yet one's compelled to. Like, if we change the way we think, might we think something new?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Ash.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
And we're joined now by George Lakoff. He's a professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley. He's a prolific author and writer. He's co-author, relevant to our current topic, of Philosophy in the Flesh, the Embodied Mind and its Challenge to Western Thought. George, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
What a pleasure to be here. I always love listening to you guys.
Well, I hope you love listening to us today. I'm sure we'll enjoy listening to you. You're known for so many things, from cognitive linguistics to the politics of framing, to your work on concepts and categories, to your ideas about the importance and prevalence of metaphor. Now, how does the embodied mind, or as you like to call it, how does it fit into this scheme of broader intellectual ideas?
Well, we think with our brains. We have no choice. And that it means most thought is unconscious. Only 2% is conscious. And as a result, the brain is connected to the body. And all meaningful thought arises from the fact that the brain is connected to the body. Now, how do we know this? Well, there's a huge amount of evidence, and began in the 1970s. First, take a look at color. Color vision was understood then, and there's no color in the world. Turns out that for color, you have to have wavelengths of reflectances in the world, but you need color cones and neural circuitry to produce actual colors. So it isn't the case, if you say something like the chair is blue, that the chair is in the set of blue things in the world. That isn't true. There is no set of blue things in the world. That means we have to have a philosophy of truth that takes into account the fact that that thought is embodied.
That sounds pretty clear. But let's just do a terminological thing. We've got the embodied mind. That's the phrase you use and like and have just explained. People talk about situated cognition. Matter of fact, that's a phrase John Barweis and I used in the 70s or 80s, a long time ago. Andy Clark is the one who really talks about the extended mind in supersizing the mind. Are these different ways of saying the same thing, or is there something about the embodied mind that it's a little clearer than the others?
They're opposite.
They're opposite? Extended They're and embodied? Are
entirely opposite, and that's what's interesting. The idea of the embodied mind that came out of the work that John and Barweis did and that Andy Clark did had to do with the view that the mind did logic and that extended to contexts, and that in order to get truth conditions in context, you had to look outside the mind at contexts in the world. This is the reverse. It says that thought itself and concepts come out of the embodiment, out of your interactions with the world and out of the way your brain is structured via its connection to the body. It's exactly the opposite.
Well, of situated cognition, I think you're saying. But Andy Clark's idea about the extended mind is that the environment is part of the mind. It's not that because, you know, a lot of what you call cognitive processing is bodily processes, and environmental processes, and you can't make a clear distinction between the external thing. It's all a big one system. That sounds more similar to you than the situated.
It is more similar. He's talking about what are called material anchors, like clocks, for example, right, where you can, you know, put off, as you said, you have ideas out there that you have to understand. You have to know what a material anchor is, but also in other people. What the work on mirror neurons shows is that there are neurons in your brain that fire when you either perform an action or you see someone else performing the same one. And that connects you to other people socially and interpersonally. That means that you're not alone. There are things called canonical neurons that fire when you perform an action or you see something you can perform it on, like I see this bottle of water or, you know, I take a drink. And the same neurons are going to be firing in either case.
This is Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We're discussing the embodied, situated, or extended mind with cognitive scientist George Lakoff.
Coming up, we're going to dig deeper into what we gain by thinking of the mind as embodied. Does seeing the mind as part of the body help us discover new things about how the mind really works? Does it give us new philosophical insight into the nature of thought, rationality, consciousness, or the emotions?
Probing the embodied mind, along with questions from our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'm John Perry. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the extended mind, or perhaps better, the embodied mind, with UC Berkeley cognitive scientist George Lakoff.
What insights into the workings of the mind do we get by viewing the mind as supersized, or embodied, or situated, or all of the above, or only one of the above, rather than just as a little black box inside the skull? Does it challenge our views about rationality, consciousness, or the emotions? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones on either side of the stage.
So, George, I want to frame this a little bit more. So here's a view about the mind that we kind of inherit from Descartes and that lots of people, at least once, it probably was once the dominant view. Mind is like a computer. It's inside the head. It does a lot of computation. It has a lot of representations. The environment and the body matters because it forces representations onto this computer, but once it's done that, its work is over. Now, I know you don't believe that. You don't think that's the right picture. John and I are philosophers. We argue about these on a priori things, on a priori philosophical grounds, but you're an empirical guy. Tell me the best empirical piece of evidence that we have to believe your way of thinking about it rather than that computer in the skull way of thinking about it.
Well, there's a great deal, but let me
try
to give you...
I know, but I don't want the great deal.
Let me try to give you an example.
Okay.
Take metaphorical thought. Why is it that more is up and less is down? And prices rose, temperature rose, etc.
Okay.
It's because there are two parts of the brain that compute, that is, react to temperature and, to verticality and quantity in two different places. Every time a child sees water going into a glass, the level goes up. Two parts of his brain notice it, if he doesn't. So what happens is there are two parts of the brain that are active together. When they're active, activation spreads throughout the brain. The more they are coactive, the stronger they get. As they spread along existing pathways, they eventually meet and form a circuit. That circuit is the metaphor that more is up and less is down. The same thing happens with affection is warmth. You're held affectionately by your parents, and you feel temperature. Two parts of the brain are active, and again, a circuit is formed for affection is warmth. Now, there are experiments that get done. John Barge at Yale did an experiment where you brought in subjects and were given warm cups of coffee and cold cups of coffee. Later, the subjects were asked immediately after that to think of meeting someone and to say what they're like. The ones who got the warm cups of coffee tended to say they were friendly. The ones who got the cold cups of coffee tended to say they were unfriendly.
So who but a jerk could give you a cold cup of coffee?
But it wasn't the person who gave the coffee that was. It was someone they imagined seeing. And there are hundreds of experiments like this. I can give you lots.
We don't want hundreds.
But you can get a couple more.
Okay, but now let me just go back to something that wasn't even an experiment that you mentioned earlier and try to tie it up with this and see if I'm way off base. You said the color, like the color on this bottle, the red color on the label, is not really out there in the world. On this, Galileo agrees with you, Boyle agrees with you, Newton agrees with you, Descartes agrees with you, lots of people agree with you. There's clearly an insight there. But people do different things with it. A lot of people say, well, the color's really not on the bottle, it's completely in our mind. Others say, well, there's color on the bottle, but it has nothing to do with what we see. That's a sign of the color on the bottle. But you see me saying, well, color is manufactured in the mind, and then it's embodied, that it's put out there on the world. And when I heard you talk about metaphor, it seems that a lot of the categories we use to describe things aren't just gotten from the things. They're a mixture of things we've gotten from different areas, put together by the brain, and then pushed back out on reality. Is that what embodiment means? The mind pushes its inventions out on reality?
That's only half the story.
Half the story. I got half the story right.
But okay. Did he get it right?
The other half is interesting, because we know more about color. Color is determined by wavelengths out there in the world, which are reflectances. They're there. It's determined by color cones. There are three, except that if you're colorblind, you have less than three. And there are neural circuits connected to those color cones that create color for you. And that gives you a perception of color in the world, and you understand that as being out there in the world, because that's what you, quote, see. You see that. You see the color, and you assume it's there. It isn't there, but that's how you are functioning.
Right,
that's how
like
we have evolved.
Kind of a joint product of at least three things.
Exactly. It's interactional. Mm-hmm. And our concepts in general are like that.
So wait a minute, though. Okay, so I don't know if I want to defend the let's see the brain in the mind as the computer in the skull hypothesis, but I don't quite understand what the challenge is to that view from what you just said. Sure, what's in the brain, what's in the mind, is a complex product of its internal nature and the inputs it gets, and it spins around and it spits out these representations, and sometimes it views them as coming from being out there, like John said, like we swash the world with colors even though they're not out there. But that's all activity in the brain. Are you saying that you can't understand? You might be saying something like this, but this seems kind of minimal and conservative, so probably you're not. But you might be saying something like this. You can't understand the operations of the brain unless you understand the body to which it's tethered to in operating. But still, the operations of the mind are just the operations of the brain that happens to be tethered to a body of a certain kind and takes that tethering and makes something out of it.
It's not just happens to be, but because of the way it happens to be, that's how we get our concepts. That's how it's possible to think at all. Look,
is that a controversial thought? That doesn't seem controversial. Would anybody deny that?
There are plenty of people who would deny it. There are people who believe that there are symbols in the brain, that there are abstract symbols. There aren't. They're just neurons. Sorry.
So here's the big dispute. The old Cartesian model, the materialized Cartesian model, says the brain is the mind, is a plenum of representations. And it manipulates these representations and reasons over these representations, and it gets these representations impressed upon it from the external world, but still the representations are all in there. That's what you want to deny? It's not a plenum of representations.
They're not representations. They are structures. In fact, in order to understand anything, you have to reconstruct it constantly because you're activating part of the brain that then activates other things in given context. So all thoughts are always remembered in that sense. But there's more. Take the very idea of thought itself. It's a metaphorical idea based on the body. You understand, for example, reaching conclusions, going step by step, where the mind is moving. You understand it in terms of vision. Things are clear, as Descartes himself said, clear and distinct ideas are murky, etc. You understand a knowing as seeing clearly. You understand the mind as manipulating objects, as tossing ideas around, communicating by sending them. You understand it in terms of eating. You can't digest all these ideas. I don't want to swallow that. You have all sorts of metaphors that constitute. They're not just metaphors for something else. They constitute our very understanding of what thought is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the extended embodied mind with George Lakoff in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater in Berkeley. And we'd love to have questions from that live audience. And we've got a questioner on this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, hi. My name is Scott. I'm thinking about the inactivist concept of perception being more active than passive. Such the idea, like, instead of there being a world out there that's, you know, that we're perceiving, we're kind of choosing. The inactivist, I think, would say more like, we're choosing what we're going to see, do you want to talk about that a little bit? Or?
Well, all neuroscientists are inactivists, and I'm one too. We are always functioning. We're always acting. The brain is always active, doing things. Perception is never passive. So you're entirely correct. There is no such thing as simply passive perception. Perception involves lots and lots of active activities. Take a very simple case from a recent marvelous book on reading by Stanislaus Dehaene called Reading in the Brain, where he points out that there's a part of the brain, which he calls the letterbox, which controls the understanding of letters, partly because you have to know what letters are in terms of the world and reading, but also they're put together not in that box, but out of other things. So in the primary visual cortex, you have center surround receptive fields, where you have centers and surrounds active. Then after that, you have lines, which are put together, that is, bound together, where you have centers that overlap to form lines. Then further forward, you have geons, where you have lines that are put together by a neural binding to form actual structures of lines, and then those are put together to form letters by neural binding. Right? So lots of this stuff is involved actively every time you see a letter like F.
But now, I just want to go back before we go to the next question. Question maybe for both Ken and you. Is the idea that these empirical results, and indeed this whole way of looking at it thing, is contrary to what I guess we should call a neo-Cartesian view that the brain is a computer and the mind is the brain? I think you got to distinguish three different ways of looking at that. One is that have to do with how people are thinking of computers. If you're thinking of computers in some kind of not very sophisticated way as a bunch of representations that somehow, well, no, it's not like that. If you're thinking of a computer as a computer of the sort that we're used to now, that have been programmed by people with representations, well, it's probably not much like that either. But if you think of a computer in a very general sense as a mechanism that deals with information, does various things with it, that's designed or evolved to create a very specific system in a very specific environment, I don't think the computer analogy, so understood, is necessarily a bad one. What do you think of them apples?
Well, as
briefly, because then we want to let some questioners in there.
As co-director of a neural computation lab for 22 years, we do modeling with computers, and we separate out what's in the model from what is in the world. We have a brain, and then in order to do modeling of saying what happens when this collection of neurons is firing and that makes other things fire, you have computer models to do that. And to do that, you say, look, there are numbers. There are numbers in terms of the amount of activation that's coming into a neuron, that is the number of ions coming in. What the level of charge you need to have it fire, et cetera.
So your answer to John is that it is a bad way of thinking or it isn't a bad way of thinking?
It isn't what the brain is, but you can model it in terms of computation to understand better how it works. It's working only by physics and chemistry.
We've got a listener on this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk Show.
Okay, my name is Kate, and I'm from Berkeley. What happens to that word that isn't there when you need it and appears an hour later? Is it in the wrong file cabinet? I mean...
No.
One of the interesting things... I would give you the name for that, but I can't quite remember.
There are two things to say about it. First, if you look at the way the lexicon is structured, what you have is connections in the brain on the left side underneath the temple, which go out in many different directions all over different parts of the brain because words pick up different parts of what the body understands. Now, the other thing is that when you start forgetting things after a certain age, you forget words and names, you might think you have early Alzheimer's. And I thought I did in my early 50s. So I called up Tony DiMasio, one of our great neuroscientists, and I said, hey, Tony, look, I got this problem. You know, I'm starting to forget names. Do I have early Alzheimer's? And he laughed. And he said, no, this is normal. What happens is that the names come in at a part of the brain where there is a bend and there's a narrow channel where there is electrical interference. And in order to remember a name, what you're going to have to get is activation from different parts of the brain overcoming that interference.
I want to ask you about a different thing. I want to ask you about, you talk about the embodied mind, but Andy Clark, a very interesting philosopher, has written this book called Supersizing the Mind, in which he talks about the extended mind. I want to know what you think about this kind of idea. And one of the things he makes a big deal of is that, think about what a cognitive process is, right? You might think that's something that happens between the ears, but especially in contemporary, highly technological world, a cognitive problem. Where is my memory? Well, I've got this iPod, I've got my computer, I've got all kinds of external aids, and my brain is kind of designed to extend itself outward, and so that a cognitive process takes place all over the place. It doesn't just take place between the ears. What do you think about that kind of idea?
It's undoubtedly true, except it's not that anything's going on out there. You are, however, seeing things and understanding things that are out there, like a clock. Clocks are understood metaphorically in terms of the notion of a flow of time, of time as moving. And so you could devise something like a clock, and then you have an aid to thinking in terms of measuring time, talking about amounts of time,
but let me ask you a question about that. When I have a hammer as a tool, it does in some sense extend my body, but it's not part of my body. So why should we think that all these cognitive aids that we engineer for ourselves is part of the mind rather than just an aid like a hammer is an aid, like a tool like a hammer is a tool?
One of the great results in neuroscience is that when you have a hammer, the actual part of your brain that sees itself in the world extends. So that peripersonal space, which is the space next to some part of the body, is further when you have a hammer than when you don't have a hammer. What's interesting about that is that the brain senses that you have a hammer, and it extends that space for the hammer into the world. Peripersonal space, the space next to something, is used every time we talk about being in front of something, being in front of you or beside you.
So is this a way of saying that my brain sort of in some sense regards, sometimes represents the hammer as part of me and that represents the iPod as part of me? Is that a way of putting that?
I don't know about the iPod, but
well, you don't rely on yours as much as I do mine. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the extended mind with UC Berkeley cognitive scientist George Lakoff.
In our final segment, we'll look at some practical consequences of seeing the mind as supersized, or embodied, or situated, or extended. From re-engineering our cognitive environments to reshaping our political discourse, advocates of the supersized mind see many practical payoffs.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. We're playing extended mind games. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the extended mind with George Lakoff from UC Berkeley. And we've got lots of questions from our live audience. Why don't we start on this side of the room?
Over Hi. There. I'm David. And I guess my question is, I'm in the boat with people who see all sorts of great questions about cognition in your discussion so far, which really interests me. I don't get yet that there's an interesting philosophical question here, because everything that you've talked about I can still imagine as being sort of modeled in the brain, and you go in there and you pass electricity in the right point and we have that experience.
Yeah, that's a very
and
good, yeah.
The only thing, you may say this is for another show, but the only thing going on that I'm not sure we know how to model yet is that somehow somebody is experiencing all this, which is maybe a little different from cognition, which you could at least model in principle in a computer.
Yeah, George, what do you think about that? Does this challenge our fundamental ideas of consciousness, experience, rationality, all those grand old philosophical notions?
Well, there are two things to be said. First, we have no way to understand the deepest parts of consciousness. We can understand things like the limits of consciousness, degrees of consciousness. We can understand attention. We cannot understand right now the idea of having consciousness at all. We can see what the correlates of consciousness are. Tony DiMasio has a terrific new book on that. But that's different from understanding how we can be aware at all. And the other question is, what is qualia? That is, how do you tell what the sound of a cello is or the taste of chocolate? We have no theories of anything like that, though we can get correlations.
But wait a minute. Isn't your way of thinking about this, you basically said at one point, it's just the neurons are not representations, it's just biochemistry, it's neurotransmitters, it's just a vat of... Isn't that basically How could you possibly get a theory out of just of consciousness, of reasoning, of rationality, of any of it, just out of that stuff? If you get rid of the representations, what do you got there? You got, and how is that distinguished from the cup, which is a molecular thing that is, you know, you can dissolve electrolytes in there and all that? How's that? I mean,
look, you've
taken away what's distinctive about mind.
No. We've only taken away a small part of what's distinctive about mind. If you look at the entire conceptual system, suppose you look, let's say, at spatial relations. Your spatial relations have everything to do with your body, which has everything to do with the fact that there is a topographic map of your body in your brain. That is extremely important. Your social relations, the ability to feel emotions in someone else, has to do with the fact that you have a mirror neuron system. Your ability to imagine has to do with the remarkable fact. The same parts of the brain that are used for acting, for perceiving, for moving, for hearing, are also used for imagining, seeing, moving, and hearing. All acts of imagination have to do with the same parts of the brain that are used for actually doing things. The same is true for remembering, for dreaming, and for the use of language.
You want to get in there, John?
Well, I just think, if you go back to David Hume, my favorite philosopher, he made this distinction between impressions and ideas, or between experience and thought. And so I would say we made a lot of progress understanding thought, the structure of thought. Thought typically is understood in terms of the world. When we have a belief, we understand what the belief is in terms of what would make it true. When we have a desire, in terms of what would make it satisfied. And I think a lot of work, including George's work on metaphor, including work in semantics and linguistics, has really clarified what thought is all about. But I kind of agree with George when you get down to what experience is and where, it's still pretty much up in the air.
Let's let some listeners in here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Tim. When I'm thinking about all this, I'm concerned about ideas like free will. And it seems like you've got sort of a mechanical, causal, connected sort of system working. Is there any role for free will? How would you frame that, if so?
Well, you know, Descartes and others argued that in order to have free will, the mind had to be abstract and not physical, or else laws of physics would apply to it. But laws of physics do apply to it because it is physical. Every idea you have is physically there in your brain. And the fact that the brain works by a least energy principle, what is called the best fit principle, it follows from physics. It has to do with conservation of energy. That's going to matter in these cases. It's going to be a physical thing.
Well, but is that there's big philosophical arguments, as some of you may know, about whether you can reconcile free will with this mechanical nature of the physical. But I want to ask you about something else, because there's something in this area I don't know about the big philosophical claims and whether this challenges how we should think about rationality and all. But there's something in this area that I think is really cool, that I do think there's a deep insight here. I just want to focus on it for a little bit. Look, I want to figure out how to, it goes back to the cup grasping thing, but I want to figure out how to, I play Scrabble, right? I want to figure out how to, what words. I got 7 letters, and I want to calculate what words. Instead of calculating all those sequences of possible words, I shuffle the letters around. That is, and why do I shuffle the letters around? Because if I shuffle them enough, things are going to pop out at me. So instead of computing, I manipulate. Right? And then it saves me all kinds of computational load. And our brain seems to design, what made me think of this exactly is the least energy principle. Our brain seems designed to not to be like this computer walking through all the combinatorial possibilities, but to find for itself shortcuts. I think that's really cool. And the work that focuses on that is really amazing.
You can go back to the psychologist Roger Shepherd, who showed that we solve lots of problems by rotating images in our mind. Now, you think if you're going to do it in your mind and not out in space, you would just do it kind of computationally. But we don't do it that way. We do it spatially.
The way that appears to work is as follows. We have certain kinds of circuits that either form holes, called Gestalt circuits, or binding circuits that fit things together, which are controlled by what are called binding nodes. And the question is, what is the best fit to a given case for solving a problem? If you have something that you're trying to reach, The question is, what is the best way to do it? And the brain does it instantly and automatically because of best fit.
Right, which leads me to a thought. I want to know what you think about this thought. Imagine I were a really practical person and I wanted to redesign educational curricula and learning styles in a basis that it seems to me that the fact that the brain is designed to sort of use manipulation, right, instead of just doing pure calculation, we should take more account of that in teaching young kids, especially young boys. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, Rafael Nunez and I have a book called Where Mathematics Comes From, showing that mathematics is also embodied and uses conceptual metaphors that come out of the body. And so that when you understand the metaphorical and embodied foundations of, let's say, trigonometry or calculus or infinity, those are embodied notions that come out like other metaphors do, and it's easier to teach and understand those things when you understand what the embodied basis of the mathematics is. Mathematics is not this abstract thing that's far away from us that you can't understand and so on. It actually does come out of embodied metaphors, and that could be used very well in teaching.
We've got time for one last question on this side of this theater.
Yes, hi, my name is Carmen, and I have a question about perception. I still remember this phrase from a psychology class that I had called cognitive dissonance, and I always wondered what happens in the brain when you're presented with facts, and somehow along the line you cannot believe these facts or go along with them or change your way of thinking. Because you're presented with something new that's factual.
Does embodied cognition have anything to say about that?
A lot, especially in the area of politics.
Well, so give us a two-minute...
Well, very simply, if you're a conservative or a progressive, you have different moral systems and different political systems structuring your brain. And so what happens if a fact comes in that... doesn't fit what you understand, the conceptual system in your brain, which is fixed, stays there, and the facts are either ignored or explained away because they literally inhibited by what's actually in your brain. Now, there are people who are partly conservative and partly progressive, and they have mutual inhibitory connections between those two parts of the brain. And sometimes they are people who are, you know, progressive in some areas and conservative in others. But when they're presented with something that is a genuine paradox, they're going to be going back and forth between them. Now, if it's just a fact and you only have one major way of understanding the world, the facts will be ignored, like most of the facts, say, on global warming.
Yeah, well, George, on that sort of pessimistic note, thank you for joining us. It's been a very embodying conversation, invigorating conversation. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you for the invitation. It's been a pure pleasure.
Our guest has been George Lakoff. He's a professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley, a very prolific author and thinker. He's co-author for the purposes of this discussion of Philosophy in the Flesh, the Embodied Mind, and its Challenge to Western Thought.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a big round of applause.
So, John, with that fine mind tethered to that fine body of yours, what are you thinking now?
Well, I'm thinking the embodied mind, as I think I'm beginning to understand it now, is to me more plausible than what some of our colleagues call the extended mind. The extended mind seems to be a marketing gimmick for noticing that thoughts are mostly involved with intentionality and we use tools. But the embodied mind has the idea that the mind is designed metaphorically, that is evolved, with a specific kind of body for a specific kind of world, and that you can't understand the whole operation without understanding that kind of three parametric relationship or more, and that seems right.
I agree with you, that seems right. But also the extended part seems right. That is to say, the mind is designed to exploit the environment to decrease its cognitive and computational load, and it's really good at that. And that's one of the reasons that we have all this technology, is because our really cool brain says, hey, I got to build me a better calculator than the one I've got. I've got to build me a better probabilistic thing than the one I have in mind. And we do all this stuff. And I think it's really cool. So,
I'm glad I have a mind.
Yeah, there you go. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. And you can also find out more about our program and about our comings and going by visiting our very, very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we extend our cognition to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. In 2010, Nicholas Carr wrote an article for The Atlantic asking, is Google making us stupid? Yes, he surmised. Speaking personally, I can't tell you how many times I've sat down to research, say, hoe-handle production in the Ukraine. Before you know it, I'm lost in a forest of links. I've forgotten what I was looking for, and I'm posting videos of puppies falling over. What happened? I used to be the king of certain kinds of bar bets. Was it Whit Bissell who gave the bad news to Melvin Douglas and Hudd, or John Fiedler? Whit Bissell, of course, but now you can just look it up on your smartphone. No reason to talk to me. I'll have to buy my own beer. Thank you, Internet, for nothing. And nobody reads maps anymore. It's all GPS. This can lead to families of five getting stuck in snowdrifts on some country road shortcut. A small price to pay for having a robot woman's voice tell you when to turn left. I just saw an ad. Two guys buy a car. One guy calls on a cell phone. Cut to a woman getting seated on a plane answering her cell. Okay, she sighs. One more time. She punches numbers into the phone. Cut back. The car's lights turn on. The doors open. The guys are amazed. My question is, why would you want to unlock your car from 30 miles away? Isn't that just an invitation to thieves to steal your car and use your GPS to drive your car into a snowdrift on some country road shortcut? What if we forget how to drive? What if text-to-speech gets so good we forget how to read? What if we get so accustomed to free access to books, movies, and music we forget how to make more? What happens when the satellites fail because we forgot how to make them and our cell phones stop working? Back in the 19th century, our lives were turgid, unreadable 50-page poems and blank verse. Today, our lives are turgid, unreadable haikus. I guess it takes us less time not to read things. That's a plus. Two reader comments about is Google making us stupid. The first, quote, with the abundance of information at our fingertips, a lot of the fat has to be skimmed to allow us to digest more. To get the point of this article across, could have taken no more than a couple of paragraphs of text, yet you chose not to be concise to prove a point, unquote. Yes, this not very concise commenter is irritated because the poor writer tried to have a prose style. The second comment does this much better, TLDR, shorthand for too long, didn't read. And yet took two precious seconds out of his life to leave a pithy critique of something he admittedly knows nothing about. Maybe there's hope for us yet. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Patrick Keane.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the Templeton Foundation.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.